You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Yanis Varoufakis achieved Europe-wide celebrity in 2015 when he attempted to renegotiate Greece's debt to the EU as Greece's finance minister during a financial crisis that paralyzed his country. He currently coordinates a pan-European political movement, DIEM25, there may be an easier way to say that, which favors, quote, a green investment program and generosity to refugees, among other ideas. He teaches economic theory at the University of Athens, though he refers to himself in his book as an accidental economist. I will let him explain that if he would. We are going to have him give a talk today, and then you will be able to ask some questions, and we will circulate the microphone. So please wait until it does come to you. We probably won't get to all your questions, but we'll get to some. And afterwards, Mr. Varoufakis will be signing his books in the lobby. When Yanis talks about the origin of debt in his book and how the banking system borrows from the future, he also talks about, quote, market values versus experiential values, which I really loved. And I would venture to say that that idea of what an experiential value is applicable to all of us in this room together right now in this library, because we've all come to listen and to participate in a discussion and to be part of a community of writers, readers, and thinkers of citizens, which is quite different, as he points out, from pushing a button on Amazon. And I say that because, just out of appreciation for this library and what it represents, and that we can all be here together today. Today, Yanis will be speaking about his book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. It's a memoir of his 6 stormy months when he pushed back against the austerity imposed on his country by the International Monetary Fund. The New York Review of Books called the book a deeply reflective first-person insight into the workings of modern power and politics. Please welcome Mr. Yanis Varoufakis.
Big brother. I can do it. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for this gracious introduction. Thank you for being here. Thanks to this remarkable institution, which, as you just heard, reminds us of certain values that simply will disappear once they're given a price. Remember Oscar Wilde's aphorism that a cynic is he who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Public libraries are a very good example of that. Now, I wasn't going to say this, but effectively you incited me to answer the question, why do I call myself an accidental economist, and indeed an accidental politician as well. And it has to do with a library, a university library, but a public library nevertheless. When I went to university in Britain to study, for reasons that I'm not going to bother you with now, I decided that I was going to study something called mathematical economics, which is a blend of mathematics and economics. The reason was because I loved mathematics and because I was political all my life. If you have something related to economics in your degree, maybe your political views are taken more seriously than if you have biology or physics. It was a very, if you want, instrumental, cynical, tactical move. But it didn't work, because after the first couple of lectures of economics at university, I was appalled by the inanity and lack of intellectual coherence of what passes as economic science. So I dropped it. That's it. I studied mathematics. I thought, if I'm going to study mathematics, I might as well study first-class mathematics rather than economics, which is third-class mathematics. And I thought I had made a clean getaway. I finished my bachelor, and then I enrolled to do a master's of science in mathematical statistics. No economics, nothing. Free. And then, after I finished the coursework, that one does as a graduate student. I had to write a dissertation. And I was trying to find something that tickled my fancy, something that was exciting and interesting. And my supervisor said, why don't you go to the library to consult your sources? Typical English upper crust kind of expression. Consult your sources, my dear chap. So I spent 2 weeks in the library reading this and reading that, trying to see, to find something that would excite me. And nothing excited me much. It was either to do with quality control of jet engines or the design of traffic systems using stochastic processes. I know. Yeah? It wasn't very exciting. I was going to choose one of these things. One night, I remember it was about 11 at night, just before midnight, actually. And I had some time to kill, so I was back in the library. And at that time of night, the library was almost deserted, if not deserted. And the lights had been dimmed to save money. And I went to the second floor of the library by accident when I intended to go to the third floor. It was so dark. And or I was so tired or whatever. And I walked down the aisle to where I thought I would find some particular statistical journal that I was researching into, the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society, something like that. But because I was on the wrong floor, my hand picked out a volume of the American Economic Review. And out of curiosity, I opened it. And the first article I saw was authored by an MIT economist, professor of economics at MIT. And it was a mathematical and statistical theory and research concerning trades union activities. And it started off with a rather controversial sentence. Employers are by nature rational, and trades unions are by nature mechanical, irrational resistors. And this paper is going to prove it. So I thought, I'm going to read this. So I continued reading, and there was a beautiful mathematical model, optimization model, constraint dynamic optimization for any of you who've had any mathematical background, that posited the employer's intertemporal profit function, the expected profits of the firm, as a function of two things, the wage rate and how much strike action the employer was prepared to take, because there was a trade-off between the two. If you wanted to settle very quickly with a union, you would have to accept a higher wage and zero strikes. But if you wanted to push their wage demands down, you have to allow them to go on strike until they their resistance waned as a result of the hardship imposed upon the members of the trade union. But it was a very sophisticated, it was a very interesting mathematical model. And then what he had done, which was quite credible, he had collected primary data from the United States, from companies like General Motors, Unilever, and so on and so forth, where there was a very interesting microeconomic data set concerning particular negotiations with all the details, how much money the trade union had in the bank, what was the level of employment, what was the level of wages in the previous years, what wage rise was granted in the end, whether there was a strike, if there was a strike, how long it was. So it was a very interesting data set. And he showed that statistically, econometrically as they call it, the data fitted the mathematical model in which the employer was smart and the union was a dummy. And then he finished off by saying that empirical research shows that the theory cannot be contradicted. That's it. And I was enraged by it. So I went to my supervisor, I said, that's what I want to do. I want to take his data and work it out for my, just test his own theories. And so, very briefly, what I did was just to take the mathematical model and turn it on its head. Use exactly the same mathematics, but assume that the union was rational, and it had a choice between settling for a lower wage without a strike or striking longer to achieve a higher wage, and the firm was the dummy that was resisting mechanically the union. And lo and behold, the mathematics and the statistics proved that that theory was just as good as his theory. In other words, you can torture the data as much as you want, and in the end, it will confess. So I came to this as a mathematician who just did not believe that the mathematical models of economists could do anything other than reproduce their prejudices. My personal tragedy was, wait for it, that this became a PhD thesis, which got published quite well, and then immediately I had offers from departments of economics, not from departments of mathematics. So I got a professorship at a very young age, just landed in my lab as an economist. Now, isn't that an accidental economist? And see how it connects with the library? Because if I had lived in the world of digitization, that would never have happened. I would never have gone to the wrong floor in the middle of the night. I would have ended up, you know, working for Boeing, doing quality control on silly jet engines. Silly jet, wonderful jet engines, but from where I'm standing now, not particularly exciting. Okay, so that's how I became an accidental economist. And I'll now tell you how I became an accidental politician. Well, my country fell into a black hole. That's how it happened. And I was watching it happen. I could see from the mid-2000s, 2006, let's say, onwards, that Greece was part of a monetary union, the Eurozone, the European Union's common currency, which was, in my view, unsustainable. It was only sustained by the American economy. I'll come back to this and I'll explain it. There was no conspiracy there. It just so happened that the Eurozone grew in an environment sustained by Wall Street, to put it bluntly. And I knew, and I started writing articles and giving speeches, and I was considered to be a complete eccentric and an idiot, saying that if I'm right in my hypothesis, the first crisis of Wall Street will mean that the euro goes. And which is the flimsiest part of the euro? Greece. Mike, just looking at the debt levels, private and public, I could see that our country was simply not sustainable. And when in 2009, immediately after Lehman Brothers and, you know, when Barack Obama was salvaging Wall Street here after Hank Paulson had already started, a new Greek government was elected whose prime minister was somebody that I knew personally, and people knew that I knew the prime minister and that we had a good relationship. Not politically a good relationship, but at a human level. At some point, I was interviewed by the BBC on television, and I spoke the abominable words. I said, let us wear it, let us accept it. The Greek state is well, truly, and irreversibly bankrupt, and any attempt to hide that bankruptcy by means of loans that will simply extend the bankruptcy into the future while pretending that it has been overcome is going to condemn a whole generation to a Great Depression and the grapes of wrath. You know, that's the kind of thing I said. Immediately, I was branded a national traitor. Immediately, I was like the cancer specialist who was blamed for the tumor and for not just bringing the bad news, but for being responsible for the bad news. And that put me on a trajectory of ending up advising several politicians, including the leader of the left, but not only the leader of the left, conservative politicians, social democratic, liberal politicians, the leader of the left, Alexis Tsipras, who in the end said to me, your proposals are the ones we're going to run with, but unfortunately we don't have anybody to implement them, so you'll have to do it. Accidental politician. Okay, that was my introduction to the main subject. Why should you care about Greece? You shouldn't. Greece is a pipsqueak country. It's only 2% of the Eurozone economy. It's the Delaware of Europe. Or the Nevada of Europe, if you want. Yeah? It shouldn't matter. Imagine if in the United States of America, for 10 years, you had a crisis. You do have a crisis, but imagine a different kind of crisis. A crisis in which every newspaper for 10 years highlights the destabilizing effect upon the United States economy of Delaware. How Delaware keeps undermining the United States economy, keeps threatening to completely blow up America, its values, its constitution, its finance, year after year, Delaware. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that if that happened, that would have been a problem not of Delaware, but of the United States of America. It would signify that there is something rotten with the United States of America, not Delaware. Delaware should not be capable of undermining the United States of America year in, year out for 10 years. The fact that Greece is still a festering wound, that our attempt when we were elected in 2015 to restructure the debt and do some things that were very, very sensible. And the reason why I'm saying that with confidence, even though we were defeated in 2015 by the creditors, was not because I thought that. I am perfectly capable of being skeptical of my own beliefs. If you are not, you are a fanatic. But the reason why I believe that we were right was because the creditors told me so, behind closed doors. I explained this in adults in the room. My greatest shock was not the way that they crushed us. No, I expected that. That's what creditors do to debtors. My greatest shock was when I first moved into the room with Christine Lagarde, who was representing the International Monetary Fund, the very institution that had put Greece into this straitjacket of bailouts and austerity in the first place. The moment we were left on our own, just the two of us, after having had this sparring match between her team and my team, and we were putting forward our case, they were rejecting our case, putting forward their case. But the moment we were left together, she said, "Oh, come on, Yanis, of course you're right." I said, "What? Of course you're right, but you've got to understand. Yeah, this program that we are imposing upon you can't work. We know that." So I'm there looking at her. What's going to come next, I thought. And wait until you hear what came next. She said, "But you've got to understand that we've invested so much political capital in this program, the one she just told me cannot work for my people, that we can't go back. And your credibility, my credibility, depends on accepting it." "What?" I turned around and said, "You're obviously confusing me with somebody who cares about my credibility with you. Because you now have 142,000 voters who voted for me personally, and I care about my credibility with them. You're telling me that they are going to be hard done by, and they are going to be incarcerated further in this debtor's prison because you have invested political capital in a failed program? Your problem." So why am I saying this to you? Because one has to ask the question, why is it that the great and the good, people I met included Barack Obama, Jack Lew, David Lipton, the number two in the IMF, an appointment from by DC, Christine Lagarde, the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, who, by the way, never contested what I was telling him either. He also agreed that what I was saying was right. But his political agenda was crush our government simply because we dared oppose their views for reasons that are very tangible and you can understand them very easily. But you have all these extremely powerful people and you can see, they tell you that they're doing something wrong about a pipsqueak country that could have been put right very quickly. All we needed was a debtor structure. Yes, we needed reforms. We needed to end tax evasion. I was the first one to say that. People say to me, "Oh, yes, but Greeks always tax evaded." Yes, Greeks always tax evaded. From before we became a state, we had an unsustainable debt. We are unique in this way. The Greek state was instituted in 1827, formally. Our public debt became unsustainable in 1824. Because the revolutionaries who had the national liberation struggle from the Ottoman Empire had borrowed a lot of money from London bankers, of which, by the way, they only received 30%. The bankers kept 70% in interest payments in advance. Fantastic. Okay, I mean, that's the fault of the Greek revolutionaries. They should not have gotten the money. So nobody needs to lecture me about the corruption, the inefficiencies of the Greek social economy. But you see, that was always the case. We didn't have a Great Depression always. put it bluntly and simply, if in 2000 we had not entered the Eurozone, we would not be having this discussion now, because Greece would not have a Great Depression. It had to do with the architectural design of the European Union, single market and single currency. So given that this single market and single currency was of the utmost and remains of the utmost importance to Wall Street bankers, to Washington, D.C., to Brussels, to every single powerful country in Europe, Germany, France, and so on, why didn't they fix Greece? Now, this is my theory, and then we can have a discussion about this, and we can elaborate further. Because Greece is the canary in the mine. You know this expression. In the old times, miners would go down the galleries carrying a little cage with a canary, so that if there was a methane or other gas leaking, the canary would die first. They would see that the canary is dead, and that would be an early warning system that there is something the matter with the mine, so that they would escape and or fix it or do something. So Greece was the canary in the mine. The canary died in 2010 or was mortally wounded. Okay, and what did the great powers do? They kept pointing to the dead canary saying, it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault. Yeah, okay, maybe it is your fault. Maybe the canary was too weak and too corrupt and too all that. Yes, but it is an early warning signal that we live in a global capitalism that does not have what it takes to be sustainable. And here I'm going to enter the last phase of today's presentation before we have a discussion. What do I mean by that? Well, our generation experienced our 1929 moment in 2008. 2008 was our generation's 1929. Now, what happened in 1929? You had a period of 10 years of immense growth, the Roaring Twenties, with very important and interesting corporations like, you know, Henry Ford's, Edison, and so on, creating out of the Second Industrial Revolution magnificent new technologies, networked firms like electricity grids and production lines and all that, which required huge quantities of finance. So banks agglomerated, united, and produced a lot of credit. Industry was doing really very well. You had the common currency in the Western world, the gold standard, more or less a common currency. And everything seemed to be on the up and up, thus the Roaring Twenties, when people thought that poverty was finished, technology was going to come. Does this remind you of anything? We've been there before. And of course, if bankers are made to feel that they can conjure up from thin air, which they do, credit, and the more credit they create, the more forms of debt and more intricate forms of debt they create, the more money they make, why not make even more of it? Until at some point, nemesis follows hubris, as we ancient Greeks used to say, those bubbles burst. And this is what happened in 1929. And what was the reaction of the Hoover administration in 1929? Liquidate, liquidate, liquidate. Austerity. At a time of shrinking private expenditure, shrinking public expenditure. The sum of private and public expenditure is, of course, national income. So you had the Great Depression, you had the Grapes of Wrath, you had John Steinbeck. Yeah? And the only thing that stopped that were two things: Roosevelt's New Deal, which reversed that trend, and the war, which created the demand that picked up the pieces of capitalism. Now, after the war, or just before the war ended in 1944, the new dealers who had had that experience, had learned their lesson from the 1929 experience, took the New Deal and globalized it. It was called the Bretton Woods system. And if you think about it, the 50s and the 60s were the golden era of capitalism. It was a period when you had steady growth, year in, year out, strong growth, 4, 5, 6%. You had shrinking inequality, magnificently shrinking inequality, low unemployment, no inflation. 20 years. How was that achieved? It was not a miracle of the market. It was planning. It was a plan of Bretton Woods. The Bretton Woods system was predicated upon a very simple idea. You had a common currency, the dollar, across the world. Of course, in Britain they had pounds, but the exchange rate was fixed with the dollar, so it was as if you had dollars. But you had capital controls. You could not take the billions and transfer them from one jurisdiction to another at the pressing of a button. And you had a very smart administration or series of administrations, the New Dealist administration, which were then copied by Eisenhower all the way to LBJ, of course, that understood that for this system to be maintained, and for America had to remain the surplus nation, the nation that was the credit nation, the creditor nation, the nation that had a surplus in trade and which was taking its profits and exporting them to Europe and to Japan in order to permit the deficit regions of this Bretton Woods system in Europe and in Japan to buy American. This is how California manages to retain its surplus vis-a-vis Arizona and Mississippi. California will always have a surplus vis-a-vis Mississippi. It will always sell more than it consumes from Mississippi, to Mississippi than it buys from Mississippi, always. How is this surplus maintained? Well, it's called the federal system and the military-industrial complex. So Social Security payments in Mississippi are funded by taxation that is raised in California. And similarly, when Boeing gets a contract to build a new fighter jet on behalf of the Pentagon whispers in the ear of the Boeing executives, yes, but you're going to have to build the wing in Mississippi. So they create a new factory there, not out of philanthropy towards the good people of Mississippi, but because that way you produce jobs and incomes in Mississippi so that the Mississippians can carry on buying Californian. It's really very simple. It's called a surplus. I call it a surplus recycling mechanism that keeps capitalism going. So the New Deal has affected that across the world in the Bretton Woods system. Remember the Marshall Plan? It was not philanthropy towards Europe. It was a way of preventing the return of the Great Depression to America. Because after 1945, when the boys came back home from the front, and the factories would switch from producing armaments to producing washing machines, there simply would not have been enough demand for the washing machines that your factories could produce here to keep busy, to keep working, and to keep absorbing the returning soldiers. So they had to sell the washing machines to the Europeans. The Europeans had no money, so they gave them the money. It's really very simple. It's recycling. And that system broke down on the 15th of August, 1971, when Nixon did this to it. Why? Because it could no longer be sustained. We can blame Nixon for many things, but not for that. It could not be sustained because America went into a deficit. So if and what happened after that? Well, after that system was blown up, something magnificent happened. The United States deficit started growing and growing and growing, and it's still growing vis-a-vis the rest of the world. But in that way, it was stabilizing the rest of the world because the American deficit was providing the German factories, the Japanese factories, and later the Chinese factories with the demand that was necessary for them to keep going. And who was paying for this deficit? Because why didn't anybody pay for Greece's deficits? Who was paying for the American deficit? Well, the industrialists, all the profit makers in Germany, in Japan, and China, who were sending their money, their profits, back to the United States in Wall Street to be invested for higher returns. But for that, you needed to unshackle the bankers to let them do whatever they wanted. So all the Bretton Woods and New Deal restrictions on the bankers, which the Roosevelt administration had put there, very sensibly, had to be removed in order to finance this reversal of the dynamic. And Wall Street built huge pyramids on top of it, which collapsed in 2008. So if you feel here in LA today that there's something the matter with the world we live in, that we have not really recovered from 2008, that the crisis that began in 2008 changes faces, mutates, travels along a very interesting trajectory, goes from state to state, takes different forms, travels overseas, comes back, but it's still with us. And we live in a society, in a social and economic world, which has not found again its poise after 2008. If you feel that, you're right. Because if you look at some basic macroeconomic data, you'll recognize immediately the problem. Allow me to put it in a very simple way, and then we'll go into discussion. Today, at the planetary level, we have the largest amount of savings in the history of humanity. Never before has humanity saved so much as we are saving now. Did you know that? Something like 36% of global income is being saved. That is the highest rate of savings since we left Africa. We're all Africans, by the way. And investment is the lowest it has been since 1945. So savings is huge. Investment is low. Investment in real things, huh? I'm not talking about buying derivatives. I'm talking about investment in really producing capital goods. Do you want to know why our labor markets are so stagnant? Do you want to know why we have Uberization of professions? Do you want to know why we have Greece being in the hole of the Great Depression that it finds itself in? Do you know why Angela Merkel is the weakest chancellor we've ever had for many, many years? Why the political system in Britain has effectively collapsed, producing Brexit? Why a fascist nearly won the presidential election in France? Why a neo-Nazi minister of police is now in power in Austria, for God's sakes? If you want to know why these things are happening and why we have this feeling of trepidation everywhere we are, whether we're in LA or in Athens, in London or in New York. That is the reason. The reason is because the Bretton Woods system and its follow-up, non-system, but nevertheless rebalancing dynamic, they have collapsed. And nothing is there to replace them. Now, clearly what we need is a new kind of Bretton Woods. Not a copy of the old Bretton Woods, but we need international cooperation between the three major economic blocs, the United States, China, and the European Union, to do that which our predecessors did in 1944. Now, for that, we need political leadership. But the tragedy of our crisis is that the crisis has produced a crisis of political leadership and has brought people like Trump into the scene. He's just a symptom of the failure following 2008, primarily of Barack Obama and his administration, to look at this as a systemic crisis and not to try to reproduce the model that died in 2008, which Obama did by reappointing the same people in that unshackled Wall Street in the first place, people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and so on. So this is why some of us in Europe at least are trying to create, by the way, it's called DiEM25, as in Carpe Diem, seize the day. You've seen the movie. So DiEM25 is the Democracy in Europe movement. We are trying to create a pan-European political party. We are going to run in the elections in May 2019 across Europe. I know it's crazy, but, you know, life is short and you have to enjoy it. And guess what our economic program is called for Europe as a whole? The European New Deal. Thank you. Okay, roaming microphones are coming your way.
First, thank you so much for all of the thousands of miles of travel, which is much appreciated. Either Tsipras seems to have misjudged you, or he misjudged his own resolve. Sort of a two-part question. Why did he choose you rather than a more establishment functionary to throw into the breach? And the second part is, what recommendations or what did you learn about the way progressive governments, once they are elected and once they have power, can begin to insulate themselves from the pressures of capital strikes and all of the things which seem to reduce progressive governments either to being much more authoritarian than is acceptable or to just reestablishing the existing power?
Okay, let's start from the second point. I think that the way to insulate yourself from the backlash that you will get from financial capital if you are elected with a progressive agenda, whether you're Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn in England or us in Greece or whoever. The way to do it is firstly by being smart and by predicting what's going to happen. So not to be caught unawares. You have to plan. And at the same time, you've got to abandon populism. And simply just make yourself an alien to populism. In other words, never go into government on the basis of an agenda which promises all sorts of things to all sorts of different people that you cannot deliver. You should only promise that which you think you can deliver. And if you can't get elected on the basis of that program, don't get elected. Because the worst thing you can do is you make all sorts of promises, like Tsipras did, my esteemed colleague and prime minister and former comrade, who selected me for the position of finance minister. I'll come to the first part of the question in a second. So when the political party that I stood with in the end, months later, put forward its economic program in September of 2014, I was living in Austin, Texas at the time. Crazy, I know. They had not consulted with me, even though we had the agreement that if they win government, I would be the finance minister. And I was outraged. And I wrote an article, which I thought was my divorce with that political party, because I thought anybody who writes this article will always be despised by the party. And the article was, it had the title, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, borrowing these three words from Winston Churchill's famous speech at the beginning of the Second World War, which is in what he said was, I can only promise you to the people of Britain, blood, sweat, and tears, but we will win. So I said effectively that all these promises we're making are not worth the paper where they are written off, and I explained why, because there will be backlash from the banks, from the central bank, from this, but we have the weapons to effect a prison break from the debtor's prison in which the Greek people are, and here's how to do it. And I still believe that those particular measures, this particular plan, would have worked. Going to the first part of the question, if you'd asked me why did Tsipras select me when on the day of our inauguration, I would have said that, precisely that, I had presented him with what needs to be done. At some point he was panicking because I told him, you know, Alexis, the moment you get elected, this is going back to what you're saying, the moment you get elected, I was not planning to be part of the government at the time. I was actually speaking to him as a consultant, as a friend, as a collaborator, a comrade, whatever. The day after you get elected, you get a phone call from Frankfurt, from the central bank, the equivalent of our Fed, that will say, sign up on the dotted line, just renounce your complete electoral program, or the ATM stop functioning. Huh? And he panicked. So he said, well, so how can we deter that? How can we stop that? So I sat down and I wrote a whole sort of proposal on a deterrence plan, which I still think would have worked. And I presented. So I thought that he appointed me for that. His explanation was, this is what we must do. As I said during my talk, I have no one to implement it. You've got to do it. And I felt a moral duty. I didn't want to be finance minister. I didn't want to be member of parliament. I didn't want to enter the party political racket. But at that point, I had a simple moral choice to make, and I made it. And I thought that that's what he was interested in. Now, what is the real answer to the question, why did he select me? If my wife was here, she would have a very definitive answer to give you. It has to do with creating the semblance of a serious clash with the creditors, putting me in front to have that clash while he himself would undermine me. Now, I'm not sure. I really am not sure. I will take that question to my grave. I don't believe in psychoanalysis, in psychobabble, psychotherapy. And I really don't give a damn about what was going on in his mind. What I care about is the fact that now we are losing 15,000 to 20,000 young people, men and women, every month to emigration. The country is in a state of desertification. What he was thinking about, what shenanigans were going on through his mind, what stories he tells himself now when he looks at himself in the mirror in the morning in order to justify what he's doing, I don't care about. You can detect that I'm a little bit bitter about this. But not personally. Personally, I'm fine. The country is not well.
Hello. We actually do have a Greece-like place. It's not Delaware. It's actually Puerto Rico. And so I have a kind of a two-part question for you. One is, just kind of Puerto Rico did, doesn't Greece just sort of, the cracks in Greece, in the wall that Greece created, doesn't that just show the kind of the instability of the greater whole? I mean, doesn't it just show the superstructure to be weak? And the second question is, do you think that Greece and or Italy will leave the EU, and what do you think will happen if that does happen?
Puerto Rico is an excellent parallel. And it's not just you and me thinking that. I was privy to a private conversation. And of course, I spilled the beans because I don't owe them any debt of gratitude. I was in a conversation that took place in Washington over coffee and cake between Jack Lew, your former U.S. Treasury Secretary, when he was Secretary of the Treasury, and Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, my great friend. And I was there, and they could see, as I approached, Jack Lew, to his tiny credit, made some noises in front of Schäuble, saying effectively that, look, you know, Yanis has a point about debt restructuring. It's important. You should consider it. You should not reject it outright. But, of course, it didn't pressurize Germany at all in that. But he just mentioned this over coffee. And Schäuble turned around, and that's what will interest you. He said, jokingly, but not 100% jokingly, he said to him, Jack, if you take Greece away from our hands, we'll take Puerto Rico. So, you see, they think in exactly the same way. But that was a joke, but at the same time signifies how the powers that be, the great and the good, the so-called powerful people, think of our communities, of our countries, of our societies as expendable colonies that can be traded, and that they have just problems. And there is also a very clear connection there, because Puerto Rico's debt is tiny. It's huge by Puerto Rican standards, but it's tiny by America. Yeah. The American Fed, you know, could just do this and just end it. End it. Just end it. So why don't they? Same thing with the Greek debt. It will never be paid. It cannot be paid. Huh? But you need to answer yourself your question. With General Motors, they had no problem wiping out 90% of its debt in 2009. The reason why General Motors is alive today and produces cars is because in 2009, the Treasury, together with the Fed, just wiped out 90% of GM debt. So they wiped out the creditors. Why don't they do it about Puerto Rico? Because they want to signal to communities, to societies, that when it comes to public debt will always be used in order to subjugate as an instrument of colonial power. That is what they want to do. So to them, it has symbolic importance. Now, Italy and Greece getting out of the European Union, I can't tell you whether they will or not. What really matters, however, is that the European Union is fragmenting. So very soon we may be in the European Union, but it may not make much of a difference. You know, Mahatma Gandhi was once asked what he thought of British civilization. And he said it would be a fantastic idea. Same thing with the European Union. It would be great if we had one. We don't have one. Okay? We have, as we speak, a Greek island, Lesbos, famous Lesbos, has been converted surreptitiously by the European Union into a concentration camp for innocent refugees from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, the Niger, and so on. We have as many inhabitants of Greeks on that island as you have refugees. They can't leave the island. They cannot go anywhere. They can't go to mainland Greece. Even if they make it to mainland Greece, they cannot travel from mainland Greece to the rest of the Union. What kind of a union is that? Yeah, we don't have a union. Now, in 2015, I was prepared, and I thought Tsipras was, my prime minister, that we were prepared to pull the plug, not on the European Union, but at least on the euro. And if we continued to be prepared to do that, there would be no need to do it. That's my view. But maybe, you never know. For some accident, we would be out. That rebellion was crushed. And now Tsipras is speaking as if he's Schäuble. This is the conversion, which is very sad for all of those of us who believed in him and believed that that particular party was not for turning. But today we're in the process of the formation of a new government in Italy. Italy is a much more interesting kettle of fish. Because if our 300 billion debt was a problem, what about the 2 trillion debt of Italy? Italy is too large to bail out. It is too large to bully. And it is too large to allow to leave the union without the union collapsing. So it will be interesting to see what happens. All I know is that an unsustainable system doesn't get sustained. You can prolong it through authoritarianism and political will. Think of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union lasted much longer than it should. It was an unsustainable economic system from the late 1960s, and it collapsed in 1991. But what is interesting with these unsustainable economic and political systems is that the longer you upkeep them through authoritarianism, the more you prolong those regimes without serious reform, without civilizing them and humanizing them, the more catastrophic their end becomes when it takes place. Now, I'm not saying this with any degree of relish, because the collapse of the European Union is not going to bring good developments. The only people that are going to benefit from that are the speculators and the fascists. So I find myself in a very, very difficult position of, at least in 2016, of having to campaign up and down Britain against Brexit. And that confused a lot of my friends in Britain. They were saying to me, why? They treated you like scum. They treated you with contempt. They crushed you. They expelled you from the government. And you are coming to us now and you're arguing that we should not vote to leave. Have you gone mad? And my argument was, no, I haven't gone mad. And I would be upset personally if I saw Juncker and Merkel celebrate following a vote against Brexit, personally. But who gives a damn about how I feel personally? What really matters is the welfare of the majority of the people in the majority of countries in Europe. That's what matters. If you're a humanist, that's what you should care for. And the majority of people in the majority of countries would be worse off if this terrible European Union collapses. That's why we're trying to fix it, and we've created DiEM25, to create a pan-European progressive movement that brings a new deal to Europe to save it from itself.
I wondered if you could comment on how the press treated you when you were in all those negotiations.
Well, you see, thank you for the question. I much appreciate it because it's such a crucial point. Every time we look at the tweets coming from Donald Trump, who has a remarkable capacity not to give a damn about the truth, and who lies to your face with impunity and without any compunction, no moral constraints, nothing. And Breitbart and all these toxic right-wing, ultra-right-wing, racist spreaders of disinformation, fake news and all that. This is pretty bad. But it's nothing compared to the liberal establishment's press for two reasons. Firstly, because the liberal establishment's press has credibility that these people don't have. So anybody who believes what Trump says, it's their fault. They shouldn't. And I don't think they do. I don't think that people who actually take seriously what Trump says actually believe that what they may like to hear it, like, children, like fairy tales, We like fairy tales. It's called suspension of disbelief. Whenever we go to the theater, we get immersed. We think this is real. We allow ourselves. We want to believe that what's happening is real. Similarly with Trump's tweets and the fake news. People are not stupid. They recognize them. But they like to play along. If they're angry and somebody tells them that, you know, a black person in Alabama killed 10,000 white supremacists simply by using his laser vision, yeah? They say, yeah, that's what I'm sure that happened. They don't believe it, really. What is far more toxic and far more dangerous is when what I experienced, I believe, not because I experienced it, but because I think it is more dangerous. You know, when I read an account in the Financial Times, or even the Wall Street Journal, less so, in the New York Times, I begin with the assumption that it must be mostly right. I may disagree with the interpretation, with the politics that goes, but I start with the assumption that they can't be making it up. So when they do make it up, it is a lot more toxic and it's a lot more problematic. What I experienced was a remarkable connivance between the worst journalists and the worst politicians and bureaucrats during my time in office. So let me give you an example. I would go into the Eurogroup, the meeting of finance ministers, and I would present my case, I would present my proposals. I would try to make them as moderate and commonsensical as I could, trying to establish a common ground between me and my colleagues. I would have parallel meetings with the German finance minister, the president of the European Central Bank, and so on. We would have very civilized conversations. They would say to me what I said before, that you are right, but we have problems. We can't confess to the fact that you are right, and so on, but let's find some. While I was in there, the tweets were coming out from within those rooms, from the minders of those people, presenting me as a time waster, a gambler, a recalcitrant, somebody that was enraging my colleagues, who was presenting policies that were not worth the paper that they were written on, while at the same time people like Christine Lagarde were saying, yes, this is the right kind of thing, we should do it, but we have problems, political constraints doing it. By the time I was out of the meeting, and you know how this thing works? I didn't know it. I found out. Journalists are very lazy. Extremely lazy. The most lazy people I know, except some of my students. So there's a pack of journalists in Washington, D.C., representatives of the different media, a pack in Brussels. So I'll talk to you about the Brussels ones. So there are about, you know, 30, 40 from Wall Street Journal, from Financial Times, from New York Times, from the Times of London, from the Daily Telegraph, the Guardian, you know, El País, the Spanish one, and they know each other. And they're not bad journalists, actually, because to reach that state. But each one of them gets brownie points with their own employer if they can bring out an exclusive. So they are dependent on particular bureaucrats from within the administration that feed them those exclusives once in a while. You know, they distribute them around so that they keep all of them happy, so that all of them can say to their bosses in Washington, D.C., in New York, in London, in Madrid, that, look, I brought you an exclusive last month, I'll bring you another one next month. Huh? So suddenly there is this very close dependence between some bureaucrat and some journalist. And then what happens is, when, let's say, you are the El País person or, you know, Wall Street Journal guy that is connected with me, I am the representative of Dijsselbloem, president of the Eurogroup, I send you an SMS during these negotiations and effectively give you the party line, as if it was the Soviet Union, that now you're going to call Varoufakis this, that, and the other, and you're going to say that his proposals are that. That SMS immediately becomes a news story for you, goes on your website, and then there is a longer editorial based on that, as if it is true. All the other 30 journalists there immediately reproduce it through their own media, and they quote you, maybe not. And then all the, you know, as you're going down the pecking order, the lower forms of human life, which is, you know, the Greek journalists, the Italian journalists, then they all reproduce it in a way which is consistent with the interests of the oligarchy that pays them. So by the time you're out of that meeting, I have I've created my own law of the world. I call it the bullshit asymmetry principle. This is a joke, right? It takes humongous effort to overturn a distortion that has already been propagated through this. The amount, you know, the amount of effort they need to put into creating this distortion is tiny, infinitesimal. And you have to spend all your life, you know, for years later, trying to say, you know, guys, it didn't happen that way. So fake news is the way in which the liberal establishment has always propagated the power of the oligarchies. What really upset them with Donald Trump and those ultra-right organizations is that they found competitors in them who didn't even try to present their lies and fake news as the truth. And they were really upset because, come on, we've been trying so hard to create credibility in order to spread fake news, and these people are spreading fake news without caring about credibility. This is what upsets them. That's my theory, and I'm sticking to it.
Hi, thanks. A two-parter. Is there any leader, excluding your new organization, that might be flying under the radar that seems to be trying to implement some of this? And the second part has to do with populism that seems, I think, seems to be growing and rising in a lot of major countries and governments. Where do you see populism? Do you think it has reached its peak or will continue for a while?
Oh, it has a long way to go. There's just one government in Italy. They control Washington, D.C. They more or less control London. They are in power in Hungary, in Poland, in Austria. They are on. They're having a party, and that party has not reached its crescendo yet. But that is not something to wonder about. Think about the last time we had that. It was the 1930s. What happened then? They had their 2008 moment in 1929. After that, austerity was introduced for the communities and for the many, for the victims of the crisis, and socialism for the few, exactly as after 2008. Very soon after that, the political establishment collapsed. Think of the Weimar Republic, the rise of Mussolini, of Hitler, of some people forget that most of Europe had Nazi and fascist regimes that either took power through some putsch or through elections. Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, they were all fascist. Croatia, Serbia, all former Yugoslavia, in the mid-war period. So we've seen it before. And remember what I was saying about savings and investment? That was another period where savings were very high relative to investment. That creates, when savings are much higher, I'll speak as an economist now. See what that night in the library did to me? So when savings is much greater than investment, the supply of money is greater than the demand for investment funds. And that pushes interest rates down. When you push interest rates down to very low levels and prices become stagnant and wages become stagnant, that creates a sense of deflation. Wages deflate. Prices deflate. Small business see that there is no hope. And that lack of hope amongst the small business men, usually, and some women, the fact that pension funds are not growing, and pension funds, especially in places like Germany now, are shrinking as they were in 1930, 1931, this deflationary economy breeds political populist monsters. It happened in the 1930s, it's happening today. This is why we believe that the only antidote is a New Deal. And that's why we call our program a European New Deal. Not that we will succeed, but it's fun trying. We may succeed. I believe that if you're not trying, if you're not, you know, too obsessed about success, your success probability goes up.
Thank you for trying.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.